A federal judge and the Trump Justice Department face off in court today.
At issue, what the judge calls a woefully insufficient response from the administration to questions about the president's use of wartime powers to deport Venezuelans.
For Friday, March 21st, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, Israel's finance minister has risen to become, alongside Prime Minister Netanyahu, arguably the most influential man in the country.
He is the primal force that is withholding the end of the war.
Also, a bidding war over a painting by Winston Churchill. Yes, at Winston Churchill.
In everything that Winston Churchill did, he was highly creative.
Speaking of Britain, a fire shut down flights at Heathrow Airport.
Plus, new music from Belgian singer Tamino, inspired by a move from Antwerp to New York.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Tech billionaire and White House advisor Elon Musk met with the Secretary of Defense at the Pentagon today. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports the White House has denied he was briefed on China.
U.S. officials had told NPR and other media outlets that Musk was scheduled for a briefing in a secure facility known as the Tank, normally used by the Joint Chiefs, and that he'd be informed of sensitive Pentagon plans regarding China, including by the head of U.S. Indo-Pacific Command. Instead, Musk met with Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth in his office to discuss cost-cutting and innovation, according to Hegseth. Speaking at the White House soon after, President Trump said he would never show U.S. war planning to anybody, especially a businessman like Musk with interests in China. Trump called reports to the contrary false and said they're meant to undermine the relationship between the Pentagon and Musk. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The White House is slashing funding to major universities, citing policy disagreements and compliance issues. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports the move is raising concerns about the broader landscape of higher education in the U.S.
The Trump administration has canceled or paused hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding to universities. This week, the White House froze $175 million to the University of Pennsylvania, criticizing its policies on transgender athletes and women's sports. Earlier this month, the administration canceled $400 million in funding to Columbia University, accusing the school of not doing enough to address anti-Semitic harassment on campus. Johns Hopkins University lost $800 million in funding from USAID, which was dismantled by the White House. Dozens of other universities are facing federal inquiries, which could lead to cuts in federal funding. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
Russia and Ukraine are trading blame over the destruction of a gas transit station in Russia's contested Kursk region. NPR's Charles Maines reports the incident came as both sides agreed to a U.S. negotiated deal to pause attacks on energy infrastructure.
The apparent attack took place at an inactive gas metering station in the Russian city of Suja near the Ukrainian border, causing a large fire to break out. Russia's defense ministry accused retreating Ukrainian troops in the area of sabotage and trying to discredit President Trump's partial ceasefire initiative. Meanwhile, Ukraine said Russia had targeted its own gas infrastructure in a bid to pin blame on Kyiv. The 30-day pause on attacks on energy infrastructure was the key outcome of Trump's negotiations with both Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky. Following lengthy phone calls this week, Trump had sought a full month-long ceasefire, but Putin rejected the deal. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Wall Street higher by the closing bell. You're listening to NPR News. Amid looming tariff threats on drug imports from President Trump, Johnson & Johnson says it will boost U.S. investments by 25%, that's more than $55 billion, in four new factories in the U.S. in the next 4 years. The pharmaceutical giant says it will add some $100 billion a year to the U.S. economy. J&J's rival Eli Lilly also announced plans for new U.S. factories last month, saying it will invest $27 billion in U.S. production facilities over 5 years. Librarians in Cincinnati got a shock recently when an overdue book was returned after 98 years. From member station WVXU, Hannah Weingartner reports it was in such good condition, it's being put back into circulation.
The copy of Wild West by Bertrand W. Sinclair was due back on November 23, 1926. Christopher Smith is a reference librarian with the Cincinnati and Hamilton County Public Library.
I've seen books come back that were due in the 80s and the 90s and even the 70s, but this is the first time I've come across a book that was almost a century overdue.
Family members discovered the book after an elderly loved one died, though Smith says it's unclear who actually checked it out all those years ago. The library no longer charges late fines, but if it did, he calculates it would be roughly $730. For NPR News, I'm Tana Weingartner in Cincinnati.
And I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew Dzingel. We receive support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. After Dark is KAXE's new Saturday night program after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk, metal, EDM, R&B, hip-hop, and more. This Saturday, our featured host Garrett will be playing punk rock. Now back to All Things Considered.
On a Friday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. We begin this hour in Washington, D.C., where a federal judge expressed skepticism today about the White House's push to deport alleged gang members under a wartime authority known as the Alien Enemies Act. U.S. District Judge James Boasberg called the expanded use of the act, quote, incredibly troubling during a hearing this afternoon. And he asked a lot of questions, both about the legal issues that this case raises and whether the Trump administration violated his orders when it deported hundreds of Venezuelans last weekend. NPR's Joel Rose was in the courtroom and joins us now. Hi, Joel.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so today's hearing was just the latest move, right, in a pretty heated back and forth over these deportation flights, yeah?
Yeah, lots of conflict this week between the White House and the judge in this case. Judge Boasberg has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from using a law that dates to 1798 called the Alien Enemies Act, and that has prompted some heated rhetoric from the administration. The White House argues the judge has overstepped his authority by inserting himself improperly into foreign policy. President Trump and other Republicans went so far as calling for his impeachment, and that prompted a rebuke from the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Judge Boasberg is still pushing the administration to explain whether it defied his orders when it allowed deportation flights to continue last weekend. Boasberg said in court today the government has, quote, not been terribly cooperative, unquote, but he did promise to get to the bottom of it.
Okay, so a lot of tension in the courtroom. What else happened in court today?
Yeah, there was some discussion about those deportation flights, but most of the hearing today focused on the law. Both sides made their case about the Alien Enemies Act, which has only been used three times in U.S. history, all when the country was actively at war. The Trump administration argues it should apply here as well because of the threat posed by this Venezuelan gang, Tren de Aragua, which the administration has designated as a foreign terrorist organization. The Trump administration says Tren de Aragua has invaded the country at the behest of the government of Venezuela. Immigrant advocates dispute that. They say Tren de Aragua is violent and dangerous, but they argue this does not rise to the level of an invasion as defined by Congress in the law because we are not at war. Immigrant advocates also say these deported people did not have adequate due process. We're not given any chance to prove in court that they are not gang members.
Well, what about Judge Boasberg? Like, what did he say about all of this?
Judge Boasberg seemed really focused on this question of due process and whether the alleged gang members have had a meaningful opportunity to present their cases. He called this use of the Alien Enemies Act incredibly troubling, quote, unprecedented, and agreed with the ACLU lawyer that the way the law is being used is, quote, a long way from the heartland of the act. Boasberg seemed very interested in whether these men had a chance to defend themselves before being sent to a Salvadoran prison, either in court or hypothetically before some other kind of hearing board. At the same time, the judge seemed wary of overstepping his authority on foreign policy, and he did not seem inclined to challenge the Trump administration's assertion about this being an invasion.
Interesting. Okay, so still a lot of unresolved questions about these deportation flights last weekend. What do we know about the people who were on those planes?
Well, we know there worth 238 Venezuelans in total, including about 130 that the Trump administration says were deported solely under the Alien Enemies Act as an authority. A growing number of family members and lawyers for those men have come forward to say that they are not gang members. Many do not even have criminal records, according to lawyers and family members, both in court papers and in interviews with NPR. They say the government's allegations are based in some cases simply on tattoos that these men have. The White House says it is confident that all of those who are deported are violent gang members, that these allegations were all carefully vetted, but the administration has not officially released all of their names or very much information at all about what they're accused of doing.
That is NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you so much, Joel.
You're welcome.
Officials at London's Heathrow Airport say some flights will take off tonight. That's after a fire nearby caused a major power outage and shut down one of the world's busiest travel hubs for most of the day. The airport says it hopes to have full service up and running by Saturday. NPR's Fatima Al-Kassab reports from London on a day of travel chaos.
All day today, the skies over Europe's busiest airport have been quiet, its terminals plunged into darkness and its runways silent. Heathrow Airport was forced to completely shut down after a fire broke out overnight at a nearby electricity substation that supplies the airport with power. The CEO of Heathrow Airport, Thomas Waldby, told local media that this was an unprecedented incident and there was no option but to close the airport down completely.
This has been an incident of major severity. It's not a small fire. We have lost power equal to that of a mid-sized city, and our backup systems have been working as they should, but they are not sized to run the entire airport.
It took dozens of firefighters hours to get the blaze under control in West London, where tens of thousands of homes were left without power and thousands of local residents had to be evacuated. More than 1,300 flights were cancelled, with hundreds of thousands of passengers affected globally. Passengers were stranded around the world as planes had to land in other cities, Munich, Paris or Reykjavik. Others had to turn back where they came from. I reached Sandeep Mahay in a hotel room he'd managed to book in Jamaica, where his plane had been sent back to, not long after he and his wife had taken off.
We were in the air for about three and a half hours. So then all of a sudden we had a message on the communications from the captain saying that there's a big fire near London Heathrow. And the airport is shut, so we can't land there.
He said their plans are still uncertain.
Yeah, we don't know when we're going to return back home. We really want to go back home. We had a big plans this weekend, celebrating my wife's brother's birthday, and we're going to miss it. So we have no idea when we're going to be able to fly back to Heathrow.
Adam Brown was on a British Airways plane en route from Washington to London. He spoke to the BBC.
Somewhere over the Atlantic, around 2 a.m. Eastern time, an announcement came over and said that there was a fire at Heathrow and that electricity was out and that we had been diverted to go back to the Washington, D.C. airport. So there were groans and grumbles, of course, and some confusion and slumber. And then we got ready and turned around and came back to the airport.
Flights to and from the US were hit hard, aviation analyst Sally Gethin told NPR.
A large amount of airlines affected are the US carriers, so particularly American Airlines had to divert a lot of flights today and overnight. So there's been quite a substantial impact on US travellers and also UK domestic travellers returning to the UK from the United States.
She says that even when flights do get up and running, the impact of the closure will be felt for some days to come.
And it will continue to have this domino effect into next week. When there's a problem, you know, at a major hub airport, it impacts the whole of the air traffic system.
Counter-terrorism police are leading the investigation. London's Metropolitan Police say there is currently no indication of foul play, but officers were treating this with an open mind. Whatever the cause, the incident has raised concerns over how a major piece of national infrastructure could be brought down so completely and for so long. Prime Minister Keir Starmer said this afternoon there would be questions to answer. Fatima Al-Kassab, NPR News, London.
This week, the auction house Christie's held an art sale in London.
The Winston Churchill, the Bay of Heirs, is work painted circa 1950, coming originally from the family, And interest here, 450,000 now, 450.
Bidding starting there at £450,000, just over $500,000 for a painting by the late British Prime Minister Winston Churchill.
500.
I promise you, it's very exciting when you're in the room.
That's the auctioneer Nicholas Orchard. He's also Christie's head of modern British and Irish art. He says a bidding war emerged.
Setting them with the absentee bidder at 500. 520, 550.
It became this backwards and forwards between these two telephone bids, you know, pushing them up bit by bit by bit.
580, 600.
To get to the final price.
Finally, one bidder took home the prize.
£150,000. So thank you to Paddle.
With fees and all, the painting sold for £945,000, or roughly $1.2 million. The work in question, the Bay of Aix,
which is on the southern French coast in the Côte d'Azur. It's a view from up and the hills overlooking the bay with trees and down on the sort of emerald waters, colours that make you just want to dive into the sea.
Churchill's love of painting developed later in life, around age 40.
He was a late bloomer when it came to the arts.
That's Timothy Riley, director of the National Churchill Museum in Fulton, Missouri, and an expert on his art.
And it came during World War I, after a disastrous battle at the Dardanelles when he was first Lord of the Admiralty. He lost his job, was forced to resign, and suffered from a situational depression. He called it his black dog. And he said that painting came to his rescue. It was art therapy, really, for Winston Churchill.
Riley says it was also in line with Churchill's character.
In everything that Winston Churchill did, he was highly creative.
I have nothing to offer but blood.
Just as he contrasted words in his famous speeches, he's contrasting colors.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight
and
on
signaled
the
how
ground.
He approached leadership.
We shall fight in the field.
He was not timid with a brush. He once said he would attack the canvas.
In 2021, Christie's auctioned off another Churchill painting, the only one he made during World War II. It was a gift for former U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Churchill composed it in 1943 during the Casablanca Conference in Morocco.
Which was a key moment in the Second World War when they were looking for how to attack the Germans or the Axis forces.
Again, Nicholas Orchard of Christie's.
And after the conference, Churchill said to Roosevelt, you must come for one night to Marrakesh. The light is so beautiful. I want you to see it setting on the Atlas Mountains. And so they went to look at it together. They spent the night. And the next day, Churchill painted that painting and then gave it to President Roosevelt. And the most recent owner of it had been the actress Angelina Jolie. So it had these two really interesting sort of ownerships.
The final sale price was more than £8 million, $10 million.
And while you may not be able to buy a piece of Churchill's work, Riley says his journey can teach all of us something.
He found time, made time, when life got difficult. It's a good lesson to slow down every once in a while in this age where things are whirling about and images are bombarding us left and right, to pick up a brush and have a go at it.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology. We receive support from Harmony Food Co-op, Bemidji's full-service downtown grocery store, offering people a variety of local, organic, fair trade, and conventional items. Open daily from 8 to 8. More at harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook. Now for your daily dose of phonology.
On today's date, March 21st, in the years 2000, 2003, and 2006, the first dandelions were found in bloom. And all of these were found in roughly the same locations, that is to say, they are all blooming on the south side of a large brick building. In one case, in the year 2000, a friend of mine brought one in from the sunny southern lawn of the Grand Rapids Post Office, a large brick building. And this is a familiar sight to those of us who examine the grassy areas located just south of these kinds of places, because the building acts as a giant heat sink and it warms the earth near the near the base of the wall, and that heat is instrumental in helping the dandelions become among the first flowers of the spring.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at dignitymemorial.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Israel's finance minister has become arguably the most influential man in the country, alongside Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's an ultra-nationalist and a West Bank settler who has repeatedly called for Israel to resettle the Gaza Strip. He has threatened to collapse Netanyahu's government if the war in Gaza ends. And this week, the war resumed after a 42-day ceasefire ended with Israeli strikes that killed more than 400 Palestinians. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalshi looks into his rise to power in Israel.
Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich was once a wanted man by Israel's version of the FBI. In 2005, Israel was rocked by mass protests. Israeli settlers were demonstrating against the removal of Jewish settlements from Gaza. At the time, Dvir Kariv was an agent with Israel's internal security agency, the Shin Bet.
ואחרי שקיבלנו אינדיקציה, נתתי הוראה למשטרה להיכנס לבית ולעצור את החבורה.
Kariv says late on July 11th, 2005, they raided a home in central Israel.
במרתף מצאנו הרבה ג'ריקנים, שהיה בהם, אם אני זוכר נכון, הרבה שמן ודלק.
He says, in the basement, we found several jerry cans filled with a lot of oil and fuel.
הם עצרו שם חמישה אנשים, בצלל היה אחד מהם.
They arrested five people there. One of them was a student called Bezalel Smotrich. Kariv says the men were interrogated for 3.5 weeks.
ולכן מבחינתנו כשבק, אנחנו הצלחנו לסכל את מה שבצלל סמוטריץ' והחבורה שלו תכננו.
From the Shin Bet's perspective, we successfully thwarted what Bezalel Smotrich and his group had planned, Kariv says. While he says he can't divulge what that was, Israeli media has reported that Smotrich and his group were planning to blow up a major Israeli highway. Smotrich remained completely silent during his interrogations and was released without charge. He did not give away his secrets, but later as a politician, he spoke a lot about what drives his political motivations. My long-term desire is for the state of Israel to be governed according to the Torah, or Jewish holy scripture, he once told Israeli radio. Smotrich is an ultra-nationalist religious Zionist, a type of Judaism that branched out from the secular Zionist movement that founded Israel. While many ultra-religious Jews historically rejected the Zionist movement, a minority accepted it. Many of them embraced the settlement movement after Israel took control of the West Bank and Gaza Strip in the war of 1967. Tomer Persico is a scholar of Jewish extremism.
The more Jews settle the lands that the state of Israel has conquered, the more redemption is coming close. So it's a messianic movement, very motivated, pious and devoted religion.
Persico says Smotrich is on the far right of the spectrum of religious Zionism, also known as ultra-Orthodox nationalists, who follow Jewish law and reject values like feminism, liberalism, and LGBTQ rights. Smotrich and his followers believe that the Israeli-occupied West Bank is the Jewish people's ancestral home featured in the Bible, a God-given land they must make a permanent part of Israel. Smotrich, a lawyer, was first elected to parliament in 2015. 2 years later, he wrote a manifesto called Israel's Decisive Plan. In it, he writes how to tackle the main obstacle to settling the West Bank, the Palestinians.
Smotrich gives the Palestinians basically three options: immigrate, surrender, and live as, let's say, subjects without the right to vote, or fight and die.
Only a few years later, Smotrich became the leader of the religious Zionist party. Ohad Tal is a lawmaker in Smotrich's party.
I think that he's a very clever and smart person who understands the reality. He's presented as somebody radical because people find it hard to accept the truth.
Smotrich was perfectly poised for what happened in the most recent Israeli national election. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu won and looked for allies to form a coalition. But he's facing trial on corruption charges. Persico says Netanyahu was desperate.
He didn't have anyone else. Because of his ongoing trial, people said they would not sit in parliament with him.
The only parties that would agree to form a government with Netanyahu were the ultra-Orthodox and religious Zionists, including Smotrich's party. Netanyahu formed a coalition with them, giving them more power than they had ever had before. The prime minister appointed Smotrich as finance minister and to the Ministry of Defense. Jewish extremism scholar Persico.
And in that position, he has basically taken over the civil management of settlers in the occupied territories, meaning he's on the verge of official annexation.
After the October 2023 attacks on Israel, Netanyahu called on Smotrich to be part of his war cabinet. The finance minister reached for his faith. I struggled with this decision and gathered my rabbis to consult with them. After all, I want to influence the war, he told a group of religious students last year in a video posted online. Smotrich is reported to regularly consult with a group of rabbis known as the Five. Rabbi Yehoshua Shapira is one of them. He has opposed a hostage deal. There is joy that hostages will return. But despite that joy, this is a very bad deal for Israel, Shapira said in an online lecture. Persico says Smotrich's faithful devotion is evident every time he threatens to collapse Netanyahu's coalition if the war doesn't continue in Gaza, where he ultimately wants to see Jewish settlements rebuilt.
He is the primal force that is withholding the end of the war.
Smotrich has leveraged this power to further settler ambitions in the West Bank. Just days after Israel paused the war in January and agreed to a deal with Hamas for the release of hostages, Netanyahu ordered the escalation of incursions in the West Bank, causing massive destruction in urban refugee camps and displacing thousands of Palestinians. Israel says it's to weed out Palestinian militants.
It's very feasible to say this is just a card Netanyahu gave Smotrich in order to appease him when going into the hostage deal.
Smotrich was sidelined under President Biden's administration for his anti-Palestinian rhetoric. And in Israel, polls show that he would not survive another election. Only 11% of the Israeli population voted for Smotrich's party in the last elections in 2022. This month, Smotrich was invited to Washington, D.C. to meet with his counterpart in President Trump's administration. Smotrich rarely gives interviews to U.S. Western media. This month, he gave his first press conference since his trip to the U.S., and I posed a question to him.
I have two questions. Do you know anything?
I asked him about plans for the annexation of the West Bank. Smotrich objects to the word annexation. Annexation implies taking something that isn't yours, the minister says. Judea and Samaria, the biblical name for the West Bank, belongs to us. Trump told reporters his administration would announce its position on West Bank annexation by early March. That date has passed. Smotrich says, Israel and the U.S. are in dialogue about it, and I prefer not to go into details. I reply.
But is Trump the man who will make it happen for you? Will he support you to make it happen?
We believe this is the right thing to do, he says. We're engaged in discussions and dialogue. So while Smotrich firmly believes he has God's mandate to take over the West Bank, the question is whether he also has Trump's blessing. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Jerusalem.
This is NPR News.
Jean-Yves Thibaudet is a world-renowned classical pianist who spent decades championing an all-but-forgotten composer.
Everybody played Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff. When you think of Russian composer, and poor Khachaturian is kind of a little bit forgotten.
I'm Scott Detrow. We catch up with Thibaudet after his recent Tiny Desk performance. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. KXE tells the stories of northern Minnesota, and we need you. Have you been impacted by federal funding freezes or job cuts? Email news at kaxe.org or text 218-326-1234. There is a meatball dinner to benefit the Bagley Senior Center Sunday, March 23rd from 11 to 2 at the Bagley American Legion. Live music by Figuring It Out follows at 2 p.m. All proceeds will go towards a new roof for the Senior Center. Now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bowles, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Educators and lawmakers are blasting President Trump's push to dismantle the U.S. Department of Education. Among them is the vice chairman of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. In a release, Democratic Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii said the Education Department is part of the federal government's core trust and treaty responsibility to American Indians, Native Hawaiians, and Alaska Natives. Schatz says over 90% of Native students attend public schools who will be at the mercy of state governments that have no legal responsibility to meet needs. The elimination of the department would affect special education, language learner supports, and Title VI Indian education programs, among others. Furthermore, Native higher education would be affected, including funding for tribal colleges and programs administering federal loans and Pell Grants. Trump's rationale includes low academic scores during the pandemic. Neither Trump nor his staff have explained how ending the department would boost student performance. The Colorado-based Native American Rights Fund has filed a lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's efforts to cut U.S. Department of Education spending. The Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez has more.
The nonprofit argues in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C., that funding cuts are a violation of longstanding treaties between tribes and the U.S. government. Attorney Jacqueline DeLeon is leading the legal effort. She says cuts, including layoffs of about a quarter of the staff, were made without input from tribes.
The federal government has to consult with tribes before they make changes to education, including to staffing, and they have a responsibility to fulfill those education requirements separately and apart from policy decisions or politics.
The suit names two indigenous colleges, one in Kansas and the Southwestern Indian Polytechnic Institute in New Mexico. De Leon says a ruling could affect schools across the American Indian Higher Education Consortium of 37 tribal institutions across the country, including those in Mountain West states. The Secretary of the Department of the Interior is named as the defendant in the suit and has not yet filed a response, according to court filings. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Yvette Fernandez.
Native American students in New Mexico will be able to wear their tribal regalia at graduation ceremonies this spring after Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham signed a bill into law on Wednesday. Reporter Jeanette DeDios has more.
Senate Bill 163 prevents school boards from banning tribal regalia at graduation ceremonies. The bill is a response to an incident that occurred last May in Farmington, New Mexico, where a Native American high school graduate was ordered to remove their graduation cap that had an eagle plume and beads. Despite some initial concerns from lawmakers, the bill passed unanimously through both chambers before being signed by the governor. Lujan Grisham says Native American students are at a higher risk of being bullied and committing suicide, and this bill encourages them to be proud of who they are and can help promote their well-being.
This is really about making sure that New Mexico stands on the right side of this civil rights issue and in the right side of kids.
New Mexico Secretary for the Indian Affairs Department, Josette Monette, is from the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa and says she's excited to see this year's graduates in their tribal regalia.
Shows New Mexico's dedication and respect for our Native students throughout the entire state.
Monette said her department plans to create a campaign that will collect pictures of this year's Native American students during their graduation ceremonies. Those will be shared on social media and other outlets to recognize the hard work of the students and the passing of this bill, which goes into effect immediately. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette DeDios.
And yesterday, we reported on the disappearance of references to Navajo code talkers on U.S. military websites. We've learned since then that following widespread outcry, those references and webpages are back up. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members serve to alleviate poverty while earning money for college and gaining professional skills. Rewarding service opportunities can be found at AmeriCorps.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Questions are being raised about the purpose of Elon Musk's visit to the Pentagon earlier today. The New York Times first reported, and NPR confirmed, that Musk was meant to be briefed on China. NPR also learned that the briefing was expected to take place in the tank. That's a secure meeting place within the Pentagon that's generally used by the Joint Chiefs. That would indicate that sensitive information would be discussed, but defense officials denied reports that it would cover classified material. So, what exactly do we know about the tech billionaire's visit? Well, that's why NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman is joining us now. Hi, Tom.
Hey, also.
All right, so still a lot of questions here, but what can we say for sure at this point about Musk's meeting at the Pentagon?
Also, what we can say for sure is that Musk was at the Pentagon. There's video of him walking in. Now, we were told he was supposed to meet in that conference room called the tank and talk about China with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and Admiral Sam Paparo, who was the top U.S. officer in the Pacific region and well-versed on China. The admiral was in Sri Lanka and was slated to take part through a video teleconference. No, none of that happened. Musk instead went up to Hegseth's office and spent about an hour and a half there, and Hegseth declined to say what they talked about. Now, some Pentagon officials I spoke with were told the scheduled tank meeting was for an unclassified briefing on China. The Times, of course, reported that this discussion was set up to talk about war plans for China, obviously very, very sensitive. Now, President Trump said this was all untrue, saying on his Truth Social site that Musk, quote, is not being briefed on anything China by the Department of War. Here's what he had to say later about Musk and the Times reporting at the Oval Office.
Nobody believed it, that the Pentagon was giving him a briefing on what war with China would look like. And he has business. No, they made that up because it's a good story to make up. They're very dishonest people.
Huh. Okay, well, I understand that you talked to some other U.S. officials who expressed concern about Musk's access to any kind of sensitive intelligence. What did they tell you?
Right. And again, the administration denies it was any kind of sensitive intelligence briefing for Musk on China, or as President Trump really said, anything on China. But officials I spoke with on Capitol Hill, they were very concerned by the report, saying it raised many questions. First of all, it does not appear Musk has the security clearance to see such highly classified intelligence, which is very closely held. What was his need to know? And who authorizes briefing, even if it were to be an unclassified briefing? Now, the other concern is this. Musk is a businessman with Pentagon contracts. What would he be learning about the various weapon systems and technologies that could possibly be a conflict of interest? And this congressional official wondered, have any other company CEOs previously received any China briefings or had any scheduled?
Well, what I'm wondering, what does all of this tell us about what the Pentagon is like under Secretary Pete Hegseth? Like, what are you noticing so far?
Well, so far, Hegseth has been focused on replacing senior officials like General C.Q. Brown and also Admiral Lisa Franchetti, the top naval officer, making some budget cuts and also doing away with programs related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. He talks a lot about bringing more lethality to the Pentagon, but we haven't heard him talk much about China or any other foreign or defense policy issues.
That is NPR's Tom Bowman. Thank you, Tom.
You're welcome.
The Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua is accused of crimes in much of Latin America and inside the U.S. President Trump recently cited an 18th century wartime law to quickly deport more than 130 alleged members of the gang, this despite a federal judge's order to turn the plans around. Critics claim Trump is exaggerating the gang's power to reinforce his anti-immigrant narrative. Reporter John Otis has more.
In this working-class barrio of Bogota, the capital of Colombia, a neighborhood watch group has installed outdoor alarms. They can be activated when people come under threat. Residents say that the main threat these days comes from the Tren de Aragua. It's a Venezuelan crime gang that expanded into Colombia and now controls drug sales and prostitution rings here. The gang also earns huge sums by extorting business owners. Police gave NPR this recording of one alleged Tren de Aragua member threatening a Bogota store owner.
Me llegaron cinco mensajes de extorsión.
Edwin Godoy, a fruit pulp wholesaler, says he and other merchants have received similar threats and that ignoring them can be fatal. People who refuse to pay extortion have been killed, Godoy says. Gang members will show up and shoot them because that's how they operate. Tren de Aragua, which means the Aragua train, was formed more than a decade ago in a prison in the central Venezuelan state of Aragua. By some accounts, its name was inspired by workers building a train connection between Aragua and the nearby city of Caracas. As Venezuela sank into its worst economic crisis in history and domestic crime became less lucrative, Tren de Aragua expanded to Colombia, Peru, and Chile.
Su forma de violencia y su...
This Colombian police investigator, who asked NPR to withhold his name out of fear for his safety, says that Tren de Aragua is far more ruthless than Bogota gangs. Eventually, Tren de Aragua began operating in the U.S., which is home to over 900,000 Venezuelan migrants. Authorities blame the gang for a wave of robberies and homicides, including the killing of police officers. To go after the gang, Trump last week invoked an obscure 18th century provision called the Alien Enemies Act that allows for the deportation of non-citizens during wartime. Although the U.S. is not at war, Trump sent more than 130 alleged Tren de Aragua members to a prison in El Salvador. Here's White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt.
These are heinous monsters, rapists, murderers, kidnappers, predators who have no right to be in this country, and they must be held accountable.
But analysts say the U.S. government has refused to identify the deportees and has offered zero evidence that they are actually Tren de Aragua members. Some appear to have been rounded up simply for having tattoos.
The FBI are basing this almost exclusively on tattoos, and Tren de Aragua do not have a tradition of tattoos. So I don't know who they're deporting.
That's Jeremy McDermott, co-director of Insight Crime, which investigates Latin American criminal groups. Due to the arrest of many of its leaders in Latin America and the closure of the Venezuelan prison that served as the gang's base of operations, he says Tren de Aragua is much weaker than it used to be. Nowadays, McDermott adds, many Venezuelan criminals are freelancers with no links to the gang.
The notion that Tren de Aragua is invading the United States as if there is some kind of cohesive, organized action, I'm afraid there is no evidence of that.
But in Colombia, where there's growing frustration over an influx of 3 million Venezuelan migrants, some people applaud Trump's draconian deportation policies and wish their own government would do the same. Among them is Armando Vergara, a retired Colombian police officer who has received death threats from the Tren de Aragua. I agree with Trump, he says. He's giving peace and security to his people. For NPR News, I'm John Otis in Bogota, Colombia.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. European Union leaders are grappling with the uncertainty of how the President Trump-led peace process between Russia and Ukraine will turn out and what it will mean for them. As Terry Schultz reports, assuming responsibility for their own security will take time that they may not have.
EU leaders met in Brussels for just the latest of several recent summits, focusing on how they're going to deal with dual worst-case scenarios: an attack by their neighbor to the east, Russia, and abandonment by their traditional ally to the west, the United States.
Within 3 to 5 years, we must be ready to be able to defend ourselves completely in Europe.
Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen is among those who've underscored the stark assessments of their intelligence agencies regarding Moscow's intent, compounded now, as the German Marshall Fund's Georgina Wright explains, by Washington's.
They need to prepare for the eventuality that the United States wants to play a minor role or no role at all in European security and defence. And so it's really living with those two potential realities side by side and preparing for whatever eventuality to make sure that Europe is in a position to respond.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has presented a plan to help governments spend more than $865 billion on defence investments over the next 4 years, with mechanisms such as EU-guaranteed loans and relaxing national debt restrictions. Countries along the front line with Russia are already spending heavily on their militaries and urging their counterparts in the rest of the bloc to lean in too. Lithuanian President Gitanas Nausėda.
Like 87 years ago, before the Second World War, we are standing in front of strategic choice: to let the aggressor escalate the violence and fear, or to stop it, to paralyze its ability to intimidate us, and to build a credible wall of defense separating Europe and Russian Federation.
But governments further away from the border don't share that threat perception. Leaders of Spain and Italy, for example, didn't like the name Rearm Europe that von der Leyen gave her plan, feeling it was too closely tied to weaponization, too focused on threats from the east. Here's how Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez described it.
The challenges we face in the southern neighborhood are a bit different to the ones that the eastern flank face. This means that we need to strengthen our border control, our capabilities to fight against terrorism, cyber attacks, and these hybrid attacks. And these are the things that, of course, we have to take into account when we speak about this new financial instrument.
The plan has now been renamed Readiness 2030, which may have just papered over a more substantial problem, says Nicu Popescu with the European Council on Foreign Relations.
The further away you're from Eastern Europe, the less understanding public opinion has about the fact that, yes, it's Ukraine's security and future that is at stake, but also an understanding that if Ukraine loses, then the threat is clearly going to be immediate, not just for Poland or the Baltic states or Romania, but also for Spain, Ireland or Portugal.
But Popescu says it may take dozens more summits before that message sinks in across all EU member countries. French President Emmanuel Macron has already called for the next one to be held in Paris on Thursday. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Setlist on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at March 21st and 22nd, Friday and Saturday this week, with shows in Gilbert, Chisholm, Park Rapids, and Duluth. Starting things off with Mark Joseph this Friday at the Ore House in Gilbert. The singer, guitarist, and Big Woo member is known for his soulful Americana and rootsy rock. The show this Friday will be a tribute to the music of Cat Stevens, with Joseph performing his 1970 album Tea for the Tillerman in full. It's this Friday, 8 p.m. at the Ore House in Gilbert. On Saturday, Morning Bird will be in Chisholm, playing Jim's Sports Club at 6 p.m. Jill Burks and Rob Wheeler have recently added a rhythm section to their folk rock sound, Jim Pietola on drums and Shane Kingsland on bass. This will be their second show with the full band, Morning Bird, this Saturday, 6 o'clock in Chisholm. At 7 on Saturday, Forge North will be at the Armory Arts and Events Center in Park Rapids. Led by singer and songwriter Charlie Wagner, they are a rootsy Americana jam band from Longville, with heartfelt songs inspired by the nature of northern Minnesota. Alongside Wagner are multi-instrumentalist Tristan Schultz, pedal steel player Matt Gutzman, and brothers Garrett and Grant Radatz on keys and drums. At the same time, two Grammy Award-winning country artists will be in Duluth at the Amsoil Arena. Dwight Yoakam, who released his first album in 1986 and most recently Brighter Days in 2024, has won praise for his authentic Bakersfield and alt-country sound. Joining him in Duluth are the Mavericks, known for their eclectic style that draws from Tejano, 50s pop, and more, and for the deep voice of lead singer Raul Malo. Dwight Yoakam and the Mavericks in Duluth this Saturday. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Well, a whole lot of brackets got busted this week after the first round of March Madness basketball. The NCAA estimates only about 36,000 perfect brackets remain of the more than 34 million brackets they're tracking.
Some of that bracket breaking may be due to the McNeese State University Cowboys out of Lake Charles, Louisiana. The number 12 seeded team pulled off an upset yesterday, beating out the number 5 seed, the Clemson Tigers. This is the Cowboys' very first March Madness victory in the team's 52-year history. Coach Will Wade said in a post-game press conference that the team's success is a huge win for the university on and off the court.
Our enrollment's up 3%. Our applications are up 10%. And we've gotten freaking $25 million worth of free advertising the last couple weeks. I mean, our stuff's going to go through the roof. It's going to change our area. I mean, we've broken every record in the book. This was the last one to get. We want to keep this going.
It's the beginning of a Cinderella story in this year's tournament. But the Cowboys have been grabbing lots of attention for another reason. The team's 22-year-old student manager, Amir Ora Khan, who's majoring in sports management at McNeese.
Khan is the ultimate hype man. He exudes swagger, as you can hear, in his signature catchphrase, which he recounted to CBS Sports.
If they kept manager stats for rebounding and wiping up wet spots on the court, I put up Wilt Chamberlain numbers.
He famously carries a boombox as he leads the Cowboys out of the locker room, rapping along with the players.
I dropped out of school, started selling dope, kept the biggest pistol even though I was a small dude. I get
He spoke with ESPN after that momentous win yesterday.
Just how cool is this for you, man?
Yeah, it means a lot. You know, I never expected any attention really as a manager. You know, so to receive all the love and support I received over the last few weeks, it means a lot to me, you know.
During the interview, a teammate handed Khan his giant boombox.
We got the boombox out now.
Yeah, it is. It's right there, you know.
That boombox, by the way, is black and yellow, branded by Buffalo Wild Wings, because Khan is the first known student basketball manager to get name, image, and likeness deals with endorsements from Buffalo, Tick Pick, and Insomnia Cookies.
And it doesn't stop there. His teammates were also showing off T-shirts with Khan's face all over them, a mirror in big letters at the top, and socks featuring a mosaic of Khan's smiling face, which the McNeese State Cowgirl Kickers danced team wore during their routine at a recent game.
Khan and the Cowboys continue their tournament run tomorrow as the team faces off against the fourth-seeded Purdue Boilermakers, giving them a chance to continue their Cinderella story and dance all the way to the Sweet 16.
A few years ago, the singer Tamino was on the terrace of his home in Antwerp, Belgium, surrounded by plants.
One day I sat there and I looked around and they had all died. And there was this one particular little willow tree that I really loved and it had died too. And I mean, I guess maybe that image was a little bit of a spark.
The willow swing.
A spark of a new song.
Sort of interesting to see a willow tree die, I guess, because they envelop themselves in a shadow when they're alive, and it's only when they die and all the vines start falling that the trunk sees the sun and it's sort of reborn.
down in silence. She will release me.
In those days, Tamino was thinking a lot about endings and beginnings. He was about to leave Belgium, where he was born and raised, to move to New York City. He kept writing songs as he settled into his new home. So when we talked the other day, I asked whether the city changed his music.
Well, it certainly hasn't become faster, which is kind of surprising, given the pace of New York.
What did emerge were songs that Tamino has called a metaphysical altar for what had been lost.
Leaving behind so many things, a place, a relationship, a younger self, maybe even a belief system.
We're hearing you grow up a little bit in these songs.
Yeah, maybe. I guess I've been growing up in public for a while.
Tamino is 28 now. He spent his entire 20s on stage, on the radio, in studios, singing raw and confessional songs. At the center of his current sound is the Arabic oud, an instrument he remembers from his early childhood after his parents split up.
My dad left behind an oud with a broken neck, and I always thought it was a very beautiful object. But you couldn't really play it because it was, all bruised. So, yeah, I always figured maybe one day I'd learn it and buy myself one.
Tamino's grandfather was a famous Egyptian singer. And Tamino has been trained in Arabic styles of music. But he's quick to point out that the way he plays the oud on these songs is far from traditional.
It's just whatever I wanted to express, I guess, or whatever came out of me, but it's not in line with any particular tradition.
Instead, the oud is just one more voice in a swirl of new music that is haunting and often mysterious. Music that is out today on Tamino's new album called Every Dawn's a Mountain.
A lot of people arrive in Washington to work for government or a law firm or a think tank. But 20 years ago, a young Russian sensation came to the nation's capital to start what would become a long career in North American professional hockey. Alex Ovechkin will turn 40 this year, and the captain of the Washington Capitals is now 7 goals away from becoming the NHL's all-time leading scorer. We go inside Ovechkin's chase of the scoring record. That's on tomorrow's All Things Considered. If you aren't by the radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by name. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits. At Progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive, Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, northern Minnesota's Apple Service Center in Bemidji and Grand Rapids, offering both in-warranty and out-of-warranty service on Apple products and computer repair. More at paulbunyan.net. Heartland Symphony presents a concert Sunday, March 23rd at 2:30 at the Gitchie Zibi Center for the Arts in Brainerd. It will feature the world premiere of Ian T. Jones' film music, a piece inspired by Radiohead. Weather tonight, mostly clear skies with lows 0 to 8 degrees. Blustery northwest winds 10 to 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, increasing clouds with highs 30 to 41. Evening lows in the mid-20s. Chance of snow after midnight with a half inch to 4 inches possible.